Okay, good morning, everybody here on Zoom. Always good to see you. Thank you for being here and there. So today we continue with our karma discussion study using the text from Chogyam Trungpa. The future is open. So last time we discussed the birth and basic functioning of karma, and today we continue along the same lines, but this next chapter or part of it deals with the question about rebirth or reincarnation, which I was debating whether or not to bring it up, but I think it's worth bringing up, especially because of the way that he wraps it up, which I think is very important for us, especially in Zen. So, it says, people often think about karma in relationship to rebirth, physical rebirth. When you die and you are reborn again, is the same process as rebirth in your everyday life situation. So when you die and reborn again, this is the same, he says, as your everyday life situation. Your first breath is dead and the second breath is being born. In other words, you die and are reborn on a momentary basis, he says. You live your whole life this way. There is a constant birth and death taking place. In terms of physical rebirth, you die and then you experience being in a state of suspension, which is known as bardo. You experience fear from the loss of your body, as well as having lost your relatives, possessions, and so forth. When you are dying, you may feel the clumsiness of having a body, and then you may experience a sense of relief when you lose your body. Then finally, you feel completely lost, and you begin looking for a new body, a new situation. At some point, you see your future parents before you enter the womb. Your rebirth depends on the level of your neurosis. The powerful flow of karma drives your rebirth. Sometimes you feel so lost that you don't care what kind of body you have as long as you have a body. You just want to get back together with a body. Then you might become a flea, or you might become a warrior, a man, a woman, or a unicorn, or a wasp. The level of neurosis, that intensity of confusion and desire, dictates different lives, different births. It is as if you are very thirsty. You are so thirsty that you will drink anything. You are even willing to drink poison if it quenches your thirst. That's the kind of desire that one develops. You want to get back to your body, find some body somewhere. So rebirth is therefore governed by the sense of desire. And everything he's talking about, we may look at it as something that happens later, but it actually happens on a momentary basis, right? That desire for something or someone, right? That sense of clinginess. So what he's saying here is the way that we experience bardo is actually governed by the way we experience and go through our lives, or the way we die is governed by, or dependent on, the way we live our lives. Because when we are dying, we're alive, right? So everything we do has the same kind of consistency, right? So the way we live is the way we die, and the way we go through the bardo experience. So he says, so rebirth is therefore governed by the sense of desire. Desire sometimes, the desire determines how quickly you want to be reborn. Desire obviously comes from looking for ground, the basic ground of security, which again is why it's so connected to our lives, which is connected again with the first skanda of form. Now the question that arises in the discussion of rebirth is this: given the reality of egolessness, what is it that is reborn? What is it that accumulates karma and therefore goes from birth to birth to birth? Egolessness is the basic makeup, our basic nature. But at the same time, knowing that we don't have a real form, knowing that we don't exist, leads to fear. We're afraid of the falseness of form or ego being exposed. Right? In other words, realizing that as hard as we grasp or have been grasping, it doesn't work, realizing the truth. Right? So we're afraid of it being exposed, and we solidify that. From that point of view, the falsity does exist in some sense. There's some reality to the falsity that has to be overcome through practice, because such falsity is very strong. Therefore, it becomes solidified as a non-existent stage or platform where you can camp or pitch your tent. It's like camping on an ice block, which eventually or fundamentally does not exist, right? So the form of ice, right, essentially depends on conditions, but when conditions change, that form will also change. So what he's saying here, you're camping on water, but still it seems solid to you, temporarily, right? That's why seeming reality or appearance is often called illusion or a rainbow mirage in Buddhist teachings. These are metaphors for the illusory quality of phenomena. The mirage exists because of the non-existence. But the non-existence has very seemingly solid ground. Thus, it is said that the truth of samsara should be realized as false, but its falsity is true. So if you have some comments or questions about that, just keep it in mind, and I'm gonna pause in a few minutes and open it up. We may still have a question when a person dies and is again reborn. What is it that passes on from death to life again? Is it a soul? Is it something like that? According to the Buddhist belief, there is no such thing as a soul, particularly. The only thing that passes into the next life is the discontinuity. Discontinuity is also continuity. In its own way. Therefore, discontinuity can continue because it can give birth. For example, if you and your parents are not separate, you can't exist. Because of the separateness between you and your parents, however, you are born. That's the very crude form of discontinuity in a family situation, where every one of the people in the family line is different or separate. Similarly, the same thing happens constantly in our state of being. An experience occurs and dies, and then a new experience is born. Then that also dies. So there is the continuity of discontinuities constantly. Now, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go to the last part of this chapter. Fundamentally, it says, we can't logically answer all the questions about rebirth and what is reborn, which I think is a very important point that he's raising here. The words become meaningless at some point. In fact, that is the point and precisely the purpose of all of this. For you to personally find out, right, so we have to experience the meaning of that or the meaninglessness of that. As far as rebirth is concerned, the main thing to remember about your death is to have some kind of openness and, again, a sense of humor. That is the saving grace. People ask me, why can't they remember their past lives, or why it's much easier to remember things that happened in this lifetime than in previous ones? This life is much closer to us. For that matter, it is much easier to remember what happened this morning than what happened last year. Our span of memory is very short because we are constantly being hassled and involved with our lives. We take ourselves so seriously, and we constantly tend to forget the long-term things. If you try to think of your past life, you will be completely confused, wondering whether you are making it up or whether it actually happened. The past is as faint as that. It's the same with your childhood. If you try to think back, certain experience of your childhood may be very faint. We take things so seriously. We are so honest and earnest and meaningful. Consequently, we have short memories. Now, in terms of our past lives, he says, I think the main thing is to realize that you're here. You're pretty certain about that. And apart from that, the whole thing might be purely a myth, which it is, in fact. Which I think is my favorite line in the whole thing I just read, right? The whole thing might be a myth, which it is, in fact. Now, why does it matter to us to actually realize that last line when we think about the idea of reincarnation? Yeah.
It just become another thing to cling on to.
Okay, another source of attachment.
Another source of attachment. More so, I think the way you just described that, and also the beginning part discussing, you know, a willingness to drink anything, including poison, to quench our thirst, is all kind of born of a really big misunderstanding, I think, or focusing on putting a wrong emphasis on the thing of going, you think the source of your dehydration, or spiritually speaking, is a lack of liquid, or you're searching for stability in a storm, and so you'd reach for anything. And in reality, that's not the reason why you're so thirsty. And in similar instances here, if you're looking for explanations as to why you're suffering in this particular moment, or if you're prone to one or two or three or several neuroses, to the point about memory, because we're such a distance from these past lives, we make up stories, and this could be another story, but then we start to remember the story rather than the memory itself, and it just becomes another thing to cling on to. And it is in fact false, but it could be a useful story, but it, in the instance that we're describing, and what we seemingly are prone to, is that it becomes another tool to create layers of delusion instead.
It becomes another escape route, mm-hmm. right? So illusory escape route, which what he's saying here, becomes real. The fact that it's an illusion doesn't mean it's an illusion for us. Mm-hmm. It may be an illusion, textbook, right? It says illusion, but for me, it's very real. And as long as for me it's very real, it is real, right? So even if I say it's illusion, it's not going to do it. It's not going to do anything, because for me, this is real, right? And the other thing, so escape route, and what we're looking for is security, ground, or grasping. And this is why he's saying that again and again. We are searching for security that does not exist, primarily because we think that we need that security, because we believe that we are not secure. Because the security that you derive from nothing can be seen as insecure or insecurity, right? Because there's nothing to grasp. So unless we can let go of the idea of the need to grasp, then we're going to keep grasping, whether we are alive or in between, as he says. And the in between is happening right now. Right, so, and the other thing about, so it becomes an escape route and it becomes another thing to grasp, but we are delaying that realization that we do not exist the way we think we exist. Right, all we're doing is delaying it. And then we are nursing delusion. Right, and we justify it.
I guess I'm curious, and this could be related to karma in a lot of ways, of, you know, I think this happens over a course of a lifetime that we experience. Eventually the ruse is over, you know, the jig is up, the old tricks don't work anymore, and you feel that kind of, not like physical exhaustion, but you've exhausted all possible escape routes and there's no escaping that, you know, the truth of the matter, or the nothingness of it. And I've always been curious, as you know, in some ways, but like not looking for a real explanation, because I think, again, to this point of explanations about these kinds of things become another escape route of going, oh, if I understand why something clicks for me and exhausts itself at 36 versus at 26, where it seems much more skillful ways to go through life, why am I so fixated on this kind of feeling that it was a delayed realization of, rather than going, I'm realizing it right now, that should be adequate. Why am I thinking about why I'm realizing it now versus later, or even further realizations that yet await me down the road?
Well, that's a direct link back to the dreamland. Mm-hmm. So I should have realized it before. But technology offers continue to offer new escape routes, right? And this is why Zazen is so powerful, or Sesshins are so powerful, because you at some point exhaust that. Yeah, I see you. You exhaust your own escape routes in the mind, and then it doesn't offer new ones, mm-hmm. right? So there's nothing to escape to. And yes, it does work as such. Yeah. Go ahead, Justin.
So in thinking about pondering, let's say, the actions that took place in a past life, I'm thinking that the case can be made that you actually do remember all of your past lives. And let me explain that case right now. Before I get into that, I'm going to talk briefly about my take on memories. So when you're remembering something that happened early in your life, you're not necessarily remembering the details, but what seems to happen is that there's this emotional intelligence of the event that took place. You're bringing up this emotional scene, and then your imagination is filling in all the details. And so I believe the case can be made that you remember all of your past lives in the sense that your karma exists here right now. And so what that means is that according to the very structure of your life, it is structured around your karma, which is the most fundamental element of your past lives that moved forward. And so it seems to me, well, of course, it's not very important to think the events that happened in your past lives, but what is important is the karma that is passed to you now. And thinking about it that way, I think it gets to the core of the utility of thinking about past lives. Because you won't get too far. It's not very useful to think about the events, but it is very useful to ponder about the karma involved, because that's what's right in front of you right now. I don't know if that's a hot take, but
that's a theory, yeah. Right? Which can sit among many theories, which become another escape route, right? So what matters, and what he's saying here, you're pretty certain about that. The fact that you're here, that's it, right? So the only experience that matters is the experience happening right now, right? So and this is where it becomes tricky, because staying with the experience intimately is very difficult for us. It's very difficult for us because it doesn't offer anything to grasp. And then we go back, yeah, but I have a memory of something, and I'm pretty sure it was real. I'm pretty sure it happened, right? It's no more than an idea, right? So, and my emotions are not great gauges for anything, right? They are very just volatile, right? They come and go, they go up and they go down. So they're not great to actually fixate on, and they take us away, right? So what matters, everything that happened up to this moment, right, in a way led us to this moment, right? So that's all it needed to do. So it is done in a way, right? It did what it needed to do. It brought us to here. That's it. So it has exhausted its need. It's not needed anymore, right? Because it brought me to this moment. And that's why the question is, now what? Not what was, now what? Right? That's the only important question. Or that's the only question that has life in it. All other questions are dead. So when we examine the way we think, often it's we are attracted to stuff that's dead. And we prefer what's dead over what's alive. So work with that for a bit. You know, don't try to understand it now, but just work with it. See where it takes you. Anyone? Okay, great. Also on Zoom, yeah, we're going to go here to this side. And on Zoom, when we're done, just unmute and speak, okay? Go ahead.
So at Sesshin during Samu, I was busy doing whatever I was doing. And I was following someone, and they had a T-shirt on. And the quote on the back of the T-shirt was, "Who are you without your story?" Right? And I didn't think much of it at the time. And is that you, Kakuo? Was that your shirt? Yeah, yeah. who are you without your story? And I didn't really think much of it at the time. I, you know, kind of just, but it never left me, that quote. And the thing that's really interesting about it is that, you know, if you think about that, everything in the past has already happened, and as you say, is dead for the most part, I guess. You know, if you approach the next moment with that, who are you without your story? Like, if I didn't have all that, you know, what would I do? Right? And that seems very powerful idea to me. From the perspective of, you know, if you're not bringing all of that baggage to the present moment, then the present moment can tell you what it needs, right? So I that's just stayed with me. Who are you without your story? Because we place so much emphasis on that, so much power is on that, and all the things you have it too. You know, all the diplomas we have on our walls, of all the things that we've achieved and all the things that we've done. You know, who are you without your story? That, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. No? Okay. Major. Okay.
Yeah, I'm playing off of what you just said, that your memories from your past, or your past lives, or your past experiences create an emotion, and they do. And sometimes you got to think about whether or not you want to entertain those emotions that are being brought up from the past, because you start saying, well, I am the person that I am right now at this moment because of my past, the experiences, and sometimes I act or behave the way that I do because I remember some things that happened in the past, and that created my karma, and that's the person that I am now. But then it takes away your free will, or your opportunity to be the person that you want to be, or show up the way that you want to show up right now, or be present in the moment of what you're experiencing at the moment, instead of spending a lot of time and energy trying to figure out, what I'm remembering, was that, is this real, or is this a fantasy, or is it, you know? So we got to be careful sometimes when we try to go too much into our past, other than appreciate the fact that all of the experiences that we have experiences have brought us, as Ms. Roshi says, to the moment of where we are now, and what we're choosing to do with that information from our past, and what we're choosing to do at this moment, right? Otherwise, it's just, you spend a lot of energy and time trying to figure out things that are not part of our present right now. Could be a memory, could be a story that we created, could be, you know, we don't know. So it's important to pay attention to what's going on at the present moment.
Right, so we don't know, but we do know one thing that we can be certain of is that when we do go to those places and we start to investigate, we know that we sacrifice this.
Yeah.
That I think that we can be certain of. right? Because when I do my mind traveling, trying to figure out things and go along with my imagination, because it's no more than imagination, even if I think, oh yeah, I'm sure it happened, right? I don't know. I really don't know, right? So, but again, I do know that in order to go there, I have to give up this. What could be greater than this? What could be more important than this? Right? And I'm not saying that this is defined. This is undefined and it should be left undefined, right? But what could be more important than this? And not only that, I think we have to take it further. What could be more important? Who could be more important than the person you're facing at the moment you're facing that particular person? Is there any more important person in the world other than the person you're facing? Right? In the mind, of course. I can list a few, right? Or a bunch. But if I don't go to the mind, I come back to this. And reality, as Coach said, reality is telling me, this is where your attention is needed. Where are you going? Where are you going? You need it here. Never mind what happened in the past. Never mind. Right? Because of that. Because of the moment, because of the situation, because of the person you're facing, you need to love this person. Yeah, but I have reservations, right? Wait. Let me just. So.
Do you want one?
No, I don't want anything. I just. So, you want to talk? You want to say something?
Ask a question.
Ask a question, and then we're gonna go to Zoom, and then raise on. How's that? But go ahead, ask the question.
Okay. So, if everything that we're embodying and everything that we're absorbing and everything that we're experiencing. I want to clarify that even in terms of physicality, energy cannot be created or destroyed. So it disappears is an illusion, and you have a soul is an illusion, but you don't have a soul, then it would be an illusion as well. Right?
Well, soul is a word, right? So what he's talking about is the continuity, mm-hmm. right? So continuity, things transform. What is it? Is not a question we can answer. It's a question we can experience, but we cannot answer. It's the desire to answer, the desire to know, I think that often gets us into a lot of trouble.
But I think that desire to experience, let's say we have a desire to experience one form after another, whether it becomes an animal form or human form or whatever transpires, if you have this desire to experience, then there is something there to experience that. So consciousness then experiences, right? And then, but it's not real?
The problem is not with the experience, the problem is with desire. The desire has its own, it leaves traces, it leaves residual energy behind, and it gums up the system and it gums up the continuity in terms of experience. The experience is fresh and new, and the experience is free of the desire. So the desire does not affect the experience, it just affects the being.
Right. What is that being?
When the desire is, when the desire dissolves, the being is the experience. Well, as long as the desire is there, then there is something fixed. There's the idea of something fixed. But when the desire, when the wanting disappears, then the being and the experience are one.
So you're saying this energy, whatever it is that we experienced, becomes unified.
Yes, yeah, so what the teachings are saying is that the answer is where the question is, not after the question.
And you don't want to define soul. This is my word, soul. This is what I go, this is how I transmigrate, or this is how I go from place
you,
to place.
We can define, but it's going to be detached. It's going to be separated because the definition itself is fixed. What we're trying to define is dynamic. there is a gap, there is a disconnect between what is fixed and what is dynamic. It's constantly changing, and then I want a fixed definition because it gives me a sense of security. This is why we want it. So the experiences don't need to be defined. We think that we want to define them.
So let's say there are people who believe that because there is a soul, you're saying this changeable dynamic energy that has a desire to impact or experience in some way, then we'll be able to, is just that dynamic manifestation of unity, that is what you're saying.
I'm saying we can play with words about that, but...
But it's not a defined aspect. And you're saying that the word soul, when we define it, soul, we have a soul, it's just to reassure ourselves like a pacifier, that we have something to go to, even though we are it and we're experiencing it. Is that what you're saying?
I think we created it so we can grasp, even when we realize there's nothing to grasp. I think we still want something, so we created something that we can then grasp.
But still there is this experiencing of consciousness experiencing itself.
Yeah. Right? One second.
Very short.
Yeah. I'll go back to you, but I wanted to see who on Zoom. Yes, so I see a couple of hands. Is that Kago?
Yes.
Okay. You're going to have to unmute. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, just speak. You want to raise the volume? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Just let me know if I need to repeat myself or something. But I think this question of the question of soul of that thing and our sangha is interesting. I'm rereading Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, which is really nice. And one thing that Suzuki talks about is that the aesthetic tradition that Shakyamuni Buddha experienced before reaching his enlightenment, there was a separation between the physical body and the soul. And the reason why these ascetic would starve themselves or weaken the body was they would try to weaken their physical self as much as possible so that they could express the soul. The thing was, if you return to normal life, you couldn't maintain that, because in order to do daily work, you have to strengthen your body, and thus you would lose connection to the soul. And Suzuki Roshi is very clear in stating that within the Zen tradition, within Buddhism, we do not practice the separation between physical body and soul. And really, a practice is separation between daily life and spiritual pursuit. It's all one and the same. And in the Dharma talk today, he says that Roshi said something like, the way that you die is the way that you are when you're dead is the same as when you're alive. And I guess that means that the way that we live is the same as when we were dead. But when he said that, I noticed that I felt scared. And I felt scared because I thought, oh no, that means there really is no escape from this. And it clued me into the fact that I was thinking of death as a escape route. I was like, well, this kind of sucks, but at least when I die. But in thinking about this rebirth process, or what's happening, what I'm hearing is that rather than being us a past life to escape to, it's showing us that there is no escape. And whatever we do now is it it doesn't end when we die. Finally, I just wanted to comment that that also reminds me of that phrase, it's the sound of one hand clapping. And one of the things that Suzuki talks about with that phrase is, he says, when one hand claps, we think that you can't clap with one hand, but you are clapping. When you clap with two hands, you can hear it, but you wouldn't be able to hear it if it didn't already exist. And he's saying that when we practice and when we live, we're always trying to add the second clap so that we can see it, so that we can see something that is already there all the time. The sound is already there. But in order to reassure ourselves that it's there, we need to add the second hand. And so I'm just thinking about that, and as my being, my entire being, being one hand clapping, and I don't need to add the second hand. I don't need to add the story to say, okay, yes, I am alive, and I am this person who's had all these memories, so I do exist. It's just, you just need to, you don't need to add all that. And your being is already all this out. You don't need to be able to look at it and hear it to know that it's there. Thank you.
Right, thank you. So the what he's saying is you don't have to add you. I don't have to add me. When I add me, I add the problems because I bring the questions. Right, and we also, you know, back to what we chant on a regular basis, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness is no other than form, right? So when we realize that form is emptiness, we don't need to bring anything because nothing is missing, right? Because the continuity continues. Because then we reside in nothingness and we don't see it as a problem, right? Because form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. When we, which is primarily the biggest issue, right? When all we experience is form, then of course we're gonna be grasping, because also we realize that that form is dissolving and freaks us out. What we don't realize is that form is emptiness. When we realize that form is emptiness, then there's no need to grasp, because there's nothing to grasp to begin with, because form is emptiness. How can you grasp? Only in the realm of form by itself, then the fears arise, the grasping arise, the neurosis, as he says, arise, right? Only within that. It's that. It's thrusting ourselves into emptiness. That's the fear, but it's also the cure. That's what we're saying in terms of practice. What we're afraid of is what is going to heal us, essentially. We're so terrified of it that we don't think that this is healing. We think this is threatening. Anyway, anyone else on thank you for that. Anyone on Zoom? Yes. Monk, yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask further about the myth, the phrase that you said with the, this is a myth. And to ask what the this part was referring to. So
you meant the last part of what I read, right? You mentioned that. So in terms of our past lives, I think the main thing is to realize that you're here, you're pretty certain about that. And a part of that, the whole thing might be purely a myth. That's what you're referring to, right? Right. Which it is, in fact. That's how he ended that part. Right, about reincarnation, right? So it's a myth because in order to create it, right, in order to go to that, you go somewhere else, right? So what he's saying is this is reality. Right now what's happening, this is tangible. This you can interact with. You are swimming in it, right? Anything else apart of that is a myth because it's not happening. Is it more than a story? Right, so even what we think did happen, right, yesterday or 5 years ago or when we were children, is it not a myth today? Is it more than a story now? It doesn't exist, right? I think we can agree on that, right? So it exists in our mind, it exists in our experiences, because we go there and we, in a way, often relive trauma, for example, right? We relive the trauma, so it feels as if it's happening now, although it's not happening now. But that, and that's what you're saying before, that while it may be a myth or it may be something that we imagine, it becomes reality for us. So we relive it again and again, but we only relive it now. Right, so even that, so as you said before, last time, in our previous study session, he talked about memory, that memory is not something that happens in the past, because we can only experience memory now. When we think about it, we think about it today, right? And that's what, so everything happens, all our experiences and the work we need to do with that has to happen, can only happen now. Can only happen now. And that's reality right now. So that's the question. Am I actually giving priority to reality, or am I just going back to those memories today and then sacrificing reality, preferring something else, preferring a myth, going back to that word? Right? And more than that, I think that, thank you, I think that we are a myth. Me, a part of reality, is a myth. Me, a part of the experience that's going on, is a myth. And I think we have a problem with that, right? Of course, Reza and then Pixie. But before that, was there somebody else on Zoom that I missed their raising hand? Yes, Fushin.
I just really appreciate the question of who are you without your story? And I remember back when, years ago, when I was working with children who were either dying or who had had the death of a parent, at that time the statistics were that 10% of children by the age of 10 had had a mother or a father die. I don't know what the statistics are now. But the work that we did had to do with not the fact that they had a mother or father die, which was real. What those children said about that. And in the work with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at that time, what they invariably said about it was that their mother or father dying had something to do with their bad self. In other words, they had either done something or failed to do something or were not something that they should have been. And had they been that, their mother or their father would have lived. And such powerful work when a child, or any one of us actually, can separate that meaning that we had added to what happened from what actually happened. Mm-hmm. And I just offer that because our brain will make up a meaning of everything. And we forget that we made it up, and then we live with that as it is the truth. And so that phrase, who are you without your story, to me was just so powerful. So that's what I wanted to offer.
Thank you. Yeah, we fill in the blank, right? And then what we're trying to work with in terms of practice is to leave the blank blank. And then the mind fills in the blank with all kinds of stories and details, right? But those stories and details are basically, we have to go back to dig in from old memories to fill it with. Because right now it's just wide open. It appears wide open. It appears blank, right? It's not blank in terms of contents. It has contents, but the contents has blank background, we can say, right? And that's the problem we're having. I want to put in some kind of facade behind it, right? So I can make sense of it. So thank you for that. Was there anybody else that we missed on Zoom?
I just want to chime in just a tiny bit because I'm so glad you like my shirt that said, "Who would you be without your story?" I just want to mention that comes from a teacher that I worked with for many years. Her name is Myron Kay. she's all over YouTube, you can see her. But she has the Who Would You Be Without Your Story is kind of her motto. But then she has a process that she calls self-inquiry. And I don't know what Charging Trungpa says about that, but it's, you know, she thinks that the way to free ourselves from our story is to examine it. And so she suggests writing down your thoughts and then looking at them one thought at a time and saying, is it true? Is it true? You know, is it? And she says working with your anger towards other people and any problem that you come across in life, you write down what you think about it and then you self-inquire. And I have, so having done this for many years, I can say that it is kind of liberating. And it brings us back to the same thing that Junryu is saying, I guess, just coming back to this moment without that sense of me. So, but I want to put in a plug for her because she came up with that, Who Would You Be Without Your Story? It's cool.
Thank you. Pixie.
Hi.
Yeah. No. Okay. Reza, then Pixie.
But Sugyoku, did you want to respond on that?
Yes, or? And then Sugyoku. Right. Sugyoku too. Do you want? Go ahead.
From a long. It was. I was just going to say in relation to Miyogen's questions.
Yes.
That I was thinking that when being becomes the experience, then the question dissolves.
Right, when emerging, when the experience of this moment includes me, then there's no, the questions arise in the gap often for us, right? So when there is a gap, there is a question. No gap, that's why I was saying that the question is, the answer is found where the question is.
The question that seems so important that we're dying to know the answer to that doesn't have an answer, the question dissolves when there's a flow of experience.
Right, but then, right, exactly. And then the questions remain when there is clinginess, when there's like, I need to know. I need to know, I need to explain it to myself, I need to explain it to others, I need to know. And that's somehow, that needs to fade away. I'm actually okay without knowing.
Right.
But hang on, we'll get to that, yeah. Okay, Reizan.
I just had a high school friend visit for 6 days, and we spent almost all those 6 days talking. High school for me is 60 years ago, and what each of us remembered was so interesting and different, right? So, and I had a very clear picture of my friend Ken, almost didn't remember, and vice versa. And, so it's an example of what we think happened in the past and what how it even involved other people as those stories grow. It was a very interesting example of how little, I mean, my sense is we're not really playing with a full deck when we deal with the past. We might have 4 or 5 cards, but there's 52 cards out there and we don't know, we have no idea even what some of those cards are or how they might relate. But the other part of that is, while we're doing all that talking, we were recreating our relationship to each other. So it was the now, and which was, in the end, more important than any of the stories that we were telling.
Right.
It was that the stories were a means to recreate our relationship to each other, but the stories were not the most significant thing. It was the current relationship, and I think that's what you're saying about the past. Like, we're not going to dispense with the stories. It's really nice to work toward that, but also to be able to see that they're another instrument, they're a tool.
Right.
It's not that they have an independent reality. Another tool that we can have for dealing with getting more into the present moment.
Right, so ingredients that you could use now and to deepen the connection.
Yeah, not to pull us out of the present,
right.
But to put us more fully into the present.
Right, so which has to do with the way you use those ingredients. Right, you could use them to mind travel and escape, or you could use them to deepen the experience of this moment.
Yeah, you can use them to feel resentment,
right.
Remorse.
Exactly.
Regret or
you also could use them to reinforce a separate sense of self, right? Or not. Yeah, thank you. Pixie, then.
So I have one question for everyone, probably not for a dialogue because I have to talk to you about this one-on-one. The question for everyone is any, I don't know how to even put this, show of hands, who like accepts karma sort of unquestioningly?
What does that mean?
Rebirth. Today we're talking about rebirth. Karma as in physical rebirth. Nobody?
What do you mean, okay, before you, what do you mean accepts?
Who doesn't struggle with it? I struggle with it. I'm not accepting it, which I have to talk to you about, but that's my problem.
Right, but the acceptance or denial are both coming from a separate sense of self. You see, that's the thing. The thing is, we have to recognize that our opinions create the problem. Right, so whether I accept it or deny, that doesn't matter.
Agreed.
So the question is, how do I leave it alone and come back to this, right? So it's not about trying to understand something as much as allowing all this to thrust us into this, deeper into this moment, right? So then realize that everything we need happens right now.
Well, that was the second.
What's the second part?
Quantum physics has pretty much demonstrated that form is no other than substance and substance no other than form. So it's backed up by modern science, and I'm not a quantum physicist, so theoretically I get it. But my sense, myself, hey, we are who we are. I'm trying to get to the state of being and accepting and living in the moment is why I'm here. I assume many of us are here. But that's a myth too. It's so contradictory. It's just, maybe if I was a quantum physicist, I'd get it, but I don't get it. Maybe. I mean,
it's paradox.
So
it has to be both right and not right.
Well, good luck to me.
But even then, that's a case by case basis of there's probably karmic interactions we're not perceiving at any given moment. It's not like everybody takes a Delhi ticket and go, you know, now serving karmic interaction 26 or something. It's just kind of all happening, and we pick up stuff, and sometimes we greet it with a lot of resistance because it's hitting a karmic nerve that we didn't even know was that raw. And
you
then
can
it's
say
like
karmic interactions.
But I don't know how else to like describe what I'm being confronted by sometimes. It could just be a phenomenon, but sometimes we add weight to it after the fact. Sometimes the weight is necessary because as we're kind of talking about the now and everything, it does have weight, but it's not the weight we're adding to it.
Okay, let me just, I want to say something about that, you know, we do need to move on, but realization doesn't need, and it has nothing to do with level of, or ability to understand, right, or intelligence, right? Intelligence is one thing, realization is another, right? So quantum physics, we don't have to know anything about anything, you know, to realize who we truly are. Anything about anything. We don't even have to know how to read one letter in order to realize. The problem is, this is where it becomes problematic, right? So that's why knowing it by birth is best. Knowing it by learning is next. Knowing it by birth, realizing that this is, everything we talk about is nonsense. Because we actually realized it without knowing that we realized it. It's just that we created problems, then we have to then solve them. That's the issue. And then by trying to solve the problems, we are creating more problems. By trying to figure out, we actually, it's like quicksand. That's what it's like. It's like quicksand. So this is where discussions are good and not so good. Because it really depends on how we do this. It's a very fine line. Because we can dig ourselves further into this quicksand or realize this is all nonsense. And I am the problem and the solution. Right? I am the problem and the solution.
Yes.
Right? But that has everything to do with how I meet this moment. Right? Because it's all here. The problem and the solution are available right now. The quicksand or spaciousness, timelessness. So this is just something, just a side note for all of us, right? In the way we're examining, we're not trying to understand anything or figure out something. That's not the purpose of getting together and having discussions, right? It's a pointer. It's a pointer to something much greater that's not nowhere else but here. So, yeah, just keep that in mind. We can talk about it further one-on-one, of course, you know, so those conversations can continue on a personal level. But great, and I want to move on, so let's wrap it up.
Okay.
And we can move on. Go ahead.
So, I just wanted to clarify my question. Clarify. It wasn't to solidify the idea of a soul, not because I'm afraid and I need it. I don't. But I was just trying to clarify the dynamic experiencer is not separate from me. And so when this form passes,
right,
that becomes another experience, you know, and the energy moves on. But that wasn't what I wanted to say. I wanted to say that, then again, and I wrote this, if you're given experiences to learn and grow, like I believe, that we're given experiences to learn and grow. We want to enter, not just because we have desire, right, and we want to cling, which happens, but because we want to learn and grow as well. So I feel like this consciousness, whatever we are, whatever this is, and I'm not here to answer that either, but it is learning and growing, right? If you don't learn and grow, even if you, like I was studying about past lives a long time ago. You know, and I get that I was getting caught up and I did this, I might have done this, you know, but then it's just, if you don't learn or grow from that experience, you get stuck. And that's where karma develops from. Because then you go into another experience and you didn't resolve this. So you're resolving it somewhere else. You have the opportunity. And then you have the opportunity. If you resolve it, it means that you've unified. It's just what I mean, right? But I don't mean like that in like a conceptual fixed state. Yeah.
Right. So well, we're gonna continue, and it actually does expand on that. But the possibility to break through and to realize and to thrust ourselves into nothingness is not dependent on anything. Nothing needs to be resolved. It's not that certain things have to happen before we realize. Nothing has to happen before we realize. There's that. Now, it doesn't preclude working with stuff that arises, but it is unconditional, right? Did you want to question?
Yeah, I was just saying if karma kind of has to do with reading one of the passages, my actions are the ground upon which I stand, but sometimes our actions create, you know, part of our karma, in a sense?
The consequences, right? So this is talking about consequences. And it's not creating a person, but it is creating consequences, right? So the way we are today will create some kind of consequences the next moment or tomorrow. The way we express ourselves today, right now, will also have consequences. Okay, I'm going to continue. And it doesn't end. We can, of course, you know, keep communicating about that, whether it's, you know, amongst yourself or with me when we talk, but we can continue to discuss this. So the next part is talking about getting beyond good karma and bad karma. In terms of working with the present situation, as we have already discussed, we are not purely talking here about having alliance to good karma and trying to avoid bad karma. That might be the temporary activity. Maybe good karma involves less neurosis of some kind in not being a savage, of instead being somewhat cultured. One learns how to behave. One learns one's manners, so to speak. Learning to behave better in a more genteel way is working with good karma. And bad karma is completely treacherous and savage and really becoming monstrous. But somehow, both of those all conditional things. Fundamentally speaking, both good karma and bad karma are a further reinforcement of samsara. Both good karma and bad karma are further reinforcement of samsara. Mahayana Buddhism in particular recommends that we get out of all karmic situations. Maybe at the beginning, the purpose of your spiritual practice is to accumulate good karma. But even that should be cut through eventually. So the basic Buddhist teaching on karma is that good karma is not particularly regarded as valuable in the long run. Even good karma still creates neurosis, and it creates the skanda of form constantly, creates me, physical, right? For example, one of the sutras related to Manjushri describes how even the faintest desire to become enlightened is still creating a karmic debt. It's creating a trace, right? And anything that is created is going to gum up stuff, right? Is going to create a layer of me, right? Wanting to become enlightened. Not even that, the statement of I want to become enlightened by itself is reinforcement of the one who wants to become enlightened. It's also reinforcing the idea that I am not. Right? But more than anything, it's reinforcing me. And that's the layer, that's the problem. The proper understanding of karma often reinforces conventional morality, encouraging us to develop good karma and avoid bad karma. Morality and karma do, in some sense, work together. Genuine morality is a state of awareness in which everything is looked at clearly and seen precisely, and everything is handled with deliberateness and precision. There are two approaches to that awareness. Either it could become good karma practice because you're trying to be good, or else that awareness could be transcending karma. If your practice of discipline and morality does not have an ego-oriented purpose, but is just to be for the sake of being, rather than to be in order to be good. And this is important, right? So to be for the sake of being, not for the sake of being good. It's not being something, it's just being. And that being is akin to actually non-existence. That's the problem for us. Because in that being, I don't know who I am. I don't know anything about anything, right? We say that the purpose of practice is to become an idiot. Who wants that, right? So even morality, right? Yeah, of course, we always talk about that. It is important, but not as something separated from, because when we are anchored, maybe not the right word, when we are experiencing being and we're okay with just being, then naturally that being, feeling integrated with everything, will act in moral ways. It's not in question. We have to practice morality because we are disconnected, right? But when we are connected and integrated, there is no question of how to act. Of course, there will be natural expression of compassion and love and care, because that's how that being is going to act when experiencing unity. And then the last part here, he says, so those are the two approaches to morality. Trying to be good is creating karma, and trying to be just because you are being, which has no purpose, is an approach that transcends karma. The true morality, Sila Paramita, from that point of view, can only develop through the practice of meditation. Otherwise, you have some object in mind. And that object becomes a source for clinging, something to defend, something to explain, something to fight over, something to kill over. on and on and on. So, somebody who has not, I want to open it up to somebody who has not yet participated in the discussion first, and then we'll open it up to everybody. So either Zoom or here, anybody that has not yet shared anything. Anyone on Zoom? Okay, so. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask you about something you said. It's a basic question, just mm-hmm. asking about a word. You said both good and bad karma reinforce samsara, is that the word?
Mm-hmm. Suffering.
Oh, okay. That was
my question. Samsara is suffering, yeah. Thank you, yeah. Yeah. Doesn't matter, go ahead.
So it's the clinging that creates the karma?
It's the clinging or the clinger. Right? So, yeah.
So, you know, you get a raise at work, you cling to that. You lose your job, you cling to that. So good karma, bad karma is just how the moment makes me feel in that moment, right? And I cling to that. I cling to that feeling. And then that creates the karma. Is that, it's a question.
Right. So the gap, in a way, the gap, right, it creates a gap, and the gap creates the problem of samsara, right? So if there is no gap, nobody wants anything else other than what's happening, right? And nobody's doing anything else other than the doing. So the doing is clean of a particular kind of result. So there's no, you're not vested in anything.
Right. And that's the transcendence.
Right, because if you—that's what he said. If you are not vested in anything, then active all day, he does nothing. He does nothing. He's not even there, right? If I want something, right? I want to create good karma. I want to create good karma. Right now, again, it's not that the consequences don't matter. Of course, the consequences matter. But what he's saying here is that, yes, we can strive towards creating goodness in the world, but then create a trace of me. I am the one who is doing good. Look at me. I'm the one who's... And then, of course, when you create that, you create the other side of that.
Right, those who are not.
Or those who are not.
Yeah.
Right, and then self-righteousness and on and on. There are many layers to what he's saying here. I think it's very complex. But the bottom line or the basic of it, right, or the basis of it is doing just for the sake of doing. And it will be what we call good. But not because you're trying to do it.
Right.
Because that's how you naturally function. Right?
Yeah.
Because you're in alignment. That's all. Because you're in alignment. Go ahead.
Well, can't being in alignment, considering yourself in alignment, be considered then you're separating yourself from that alignment by saying, I'm aligned and nobody else is. I'm self-righteous. I'm doing it the right way.
Yes.
Everybody else is doing it the wrong way.
Right. So,
and
so.
Then, and then chastising people.
So that's why the Supreme Way is without difficulty, just to avoid picking and choosing, right? So picking and choosing creates that. That's why it's a brilliant line, right, the text, because this is it's the same thing, right? Avoid picking and choosing, but I'm choosing good, right? I know what I'm choosing, and I'm choosing a direction that has goodness in it. It's still picking and choosing. And the picking and choosing is creating me. So that's the freedom, right? Not the trap, the freedom. Avoid picking and choosing. One second, I think I saw... Sigurka, did you raise your hand? No? Okay. Was there anyone else? Yeah.
It's something interesting happening there. I think that's important of... We've kind of been talking about how do we examine these things in a lot of ways. If we examine them as something to break into individual pieces and create further gaps, or mm-hmm. if we examine them as seeking stability by way of predictability, of going, if I do X action, Y positive thing takes mm-hmm. place. I think also if we engage in it, because so much of what we read and talk about mentions things like merit accumulation. And what you're saying, and I think that it's an important distinction, it's saying that when you achieve a certain, you know, that fluidity of experience, the ceasing of the existence of boundaries, merit accumulation is happening, but it's not why you're doing it, you're just doing it. There is no thought process on it. And I think the interesting thing for me becomes, with so much of our practice in Zazen, you know, being about not figuring it out, but looking at it, is going, how do we examine that, those moments? Because I feel like they are brief moments. It's not just like something cracks and then you're in alignment for the rest of your mortal existence. It happens in these moments. And we do look back and go, yeah, why did I do that? You know, I just went into action the same, like a good Samaritan or something mm-hmm. like that, the way somebody might react to somebody in an accident. They don't think and go, oh, this is gonna, you know, increase my merit score by 5 points or whatever. You know, they just, you just see people jump in mm-hmm. when, if they, you know, one could make the argument if they did all the checks and balances and weighed it out, they would go, this is a huge risk to me to jump into a flaming building. Why mm-hmm. did I do this? But in that moment, they're aligned with it. The good or bad kind of doesn't really exist in that. It does, but it doesn't. You know, I think it's about these gaps that are created by going, if you put too much effort into how I go through the world rather than just going through the world, of going, I think I don't know, it's just interesting. I to circle back, I guess, to the initial question was like, what does the examining look like then at that point? Of, we look at what we've done or what we're doing or how we're going through life, how we're creating suffering for ourselves and others. How do we engage in these things? Not from a standpoint of figuring something out, but of right. cutting to reality with the sword.
So, right, so it is the true morality from that point of view can only be developed through the practice of meditation. Otherwise, you have some object in mind. So that's taking care of your question right there.
A question on a few more words in a relationship with one another.
Yeah.
Is samsara associated with the shape of a wheel of samsara? Is that another kind of...
Right, we continue to create further suffering, right? So there's the, right, so you can turn the Dharma wheel or you can turn the wheel of samsara too. Right, so you can turn the wheel of wisdom, right, by the way we are turning something, right? So our life can be turning the wheel of samsara and create further samsara, or we can be turning the wheel of wisdom, so to speak, right? And
also,
yeah.
Is there a relationship between the word samsara and dukkha? Because I thought dukkha was also suffering.
Yeah, dukkha is right. Dukkha is the experience, right? So the experience of samsara, we experience this dukkha in our
okay.
lives, right?
Dukkha is the experience of turning the wheel of
right.
samsara.
Another dissatisfaction, unhappiness, disconnectedness.
Okay, one more question. If someone is involved in doing deep prajna paramita,
mm-hmm.
is that a state of samadhi?
Or is there a connection? Yeah, yes. So dynamic or positive samadhi, as Sekida calls it, right? So there is absolute samadhi, based on the way he defined it, as absolute samadhi and positive samadhi. Absolute samadhi is what you experience in meditation, and positive samadhi is what you may experience in actualizing the fundamental point, right? So Dogen, actualizing the fundamental point is that. So going from nothing to something, back to nothing, it expresses itself in that way, right? Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? Yeah.
I was just thinking of the idea of focusing on making good karma and The more I thought about it, it seemed like it was very restrictive. Because you might think of like, oh, to practice good karma, it would be to, oh, you gotta be a good little boy or just never harm people and stuff like that. But you don't know that for sure. What if me trying to do something good, I F up and I hurt people in that? Whereas, like you've mentioned, with being in alignment, it's not guaranteed to do something good, but how can I say it? It's just that you're in alignment with yourself, or for lack of better terms, your own values, sticking to your guns. But yeah, that's just all I have to say about that.
Right. So yes, you bring up the point of what you... So you may act in a certain way, and you think if I act a certain way, it will yield this result or results, right? And you don't know, right? So you may think you're doing something good, or you may think you're doing something bad, but you don't know what it will lead to, right? Which, again, brings us right back to this. Right, so we are being for the sake of being, as he says. Being for the sake of being is not vested in, and therefore it's not about, well, I'm disappointed, it should have been differently, now I have to deal with that, I don't want to deal with that, right? All that is taken off the plate in a way, right? Because it's the way it is, and you meet it. You meet it from a place of no expectation. Right? Because there's nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Right? When being is for the sake of being, there is nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Yes, so Rezan will have the last word.
Wow. I'm hearing two different ideas of karma, and I want to see whether this makes some sense. One karma is playground bullying that can kind of an irrational force in our lives that has some sort of control over us, and there's very much the other, and we can't get much access to it. And the other one seems to be our best friend, that is an extension of ourselves and is somehow a connection of us to the world, and is there is a resource for us. At least for me, it's important to have a sense of those two different types of, or appreciations of, or experiences of karma. It's not, I think, something that we can totally dispense with, because it's going to be part of any effort that we try to go forward in the world. So those two images somewhat work for me, and it's, I don't know if any of you had a bully who actually became your best friend. That would be a wonderful experience in your life. But that seems to be the course of much of my practice, moving in that direction, from seeing karma as something that doesn't limit you from the outside, but actually helps you expand out.
Right. So when he talks about transcending karma, he's talking about working with it. Right? He's not talking about ignoring anything, right? Everything is included in that, and it's a question of how.
Right.
How do I meet it, right? Or we can ask, who is meeting it? That's another way to cut through. Who is meeting it? Right? So it's another opening. Yeah, thank you. Okay, let's finish.
I bow to freedom. become the of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Each of us must strive to awaken. Awaken. Take heed. Do not squander your life.